Hi, everyone, and thank you for joining the Clinical Laboratory COVID-19 Response Call. I'm Jasmine Chaitram. I'm with the Division of Laboratory Systems at CDC, and the Division of Laboratory Systems at CDC hosts these calls, and we've been doing that since March of this year. First, I want to wish everyone a late happy Thanksgiving, and I hope that all of you on the call today had some time to rest and just kind of take a breather from all of the craziness and activities that are going on right now to support the response. Showing today's agenda, we've got a list of really great speakers. Before we get into our speakers, though, I do have a few announcements. And before I even do the announcements, I want to remind everybody that the CDC Division of Laboratory Systems has been working with clinical and public health laboratories for years now. And we're supporting them on issues like quality and safety, workforce and training, informatics, biorepository and data science. We've also been supporting them for public health emergency response, and we've been doing that throughout the COVID response. We were doing it in preparation for a pandemic like this or other outbreaks. We're serving as a liaison between the clinical laboratory community and the CDC Emergency Operations Center. And that's why we host these calls to provide this communication to you, and hopefully it is relevant and timely. And on to some announcements. So the first thing is, and I've said this before, we have our CDC preparedness portal. This is a DLS hosted website, and this is where you can find information about our clinical laboratory COVID-19 response calls. That includes transcripts and audio recordings. All of the information is usually posted within a week of our call. So if you miss the call for some reason or you want to share the information with a colleague, just send them to this website. Asking a question, it's important that you use the Q&A button in the Zoom webinar system and type your question into that Q&A box. We will do our best to answer the questions during the call. Unfortunately, because of the number of questions and the amount of time we have for these calls, we don't always get to answer all of the questions, but we do try to provide a response, if not live, then shortly thereafter. And if not, then we usually bump the question to the next call or use it to help us form an agenda topic for future call. So please submit your questions this way. And also as a reminder, because we can't answer all of these questions on the call, please submit your email with your question if you want us to respond to you. And if you're the media, please send your questions to CDC Media Relations at media@cdc.gov. And if you're a patient, please direct your questions to your healthcare provider. The next call will be on Monday, December 14th. We are doing these calls every other week at this point in time. Here I'm showing a list of CLIA-approved proficiency testing programs for SARS-CoV-2. We've shown this list before, but this is an updated list. And we also wanted you to be aware that some of these PT providers are going to be, if not already, in the very near future, providing PT for antigen tests as well. And as usual, here's our links to COVID-19 resources for laboratories. We put these links in the slides. The slides are on the preparedness portal. So if you want to go back to the slides to find a link to information, we put them here as easy access for you, one-stop shopping, by going to our preparedness portal and our slides. We also like to get feedback from you on training and workforce development needs. Please email those needs to labtrainingneeds@cdc.gov, and we will try to address those in various ways, whether that's a presentation or the development of an actual online training or other mechanisms. And then I wanted to also make an announcement about a recent LOCS message. That's LOCS Laboratory Outreach Communication System. That's how we communicate with all of our clinical laboratories and provide information by email when we're not having these calls. We also use LOCS to announce these calls. So if you're not signed up for LOCS, please do that by sending an email to locs@cdc.gov, so locs@cdc.gov. We had a recent message that went out about waste management guidance for SARS-CoV-2 point of care testing. And we did get a question. And we thought that, it may be a question on the minds of many of you. So we've actually asked Bill Arndt from the Division of Laboratory Systems to join us today to give us a little bit more information. Bill, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead and take it away.
Yeah, thanks, Jasmine. So the question we got was related to disposing of home collection kits in the general home waste, and should that waste be treated as a biohazardous waste that would typically come out of a laboratory? From the CDC's perspective, this is a risk assessment question. After a testing at home, you will have potentially one used test that is discarded in a in your general trash, which is compared to such as a nursing home or a hospital or a laboratory, which generates or thousands of tests and discards those in large volumes. The risk of disposing of a single test in your general trash, the risk of exposure is considered relatively low, and low in that it's going to contaminate, less of a chance to contaminate other materials, as well as less chance to for a potential exposure. So at this time, the CDC does not see the waste generated from the at-home collections as a biohazard, such as it does with normal waste that you would see generated in larger volumes from laboratories or nursing homes or hospitals. Thanks, Jasmine.
Thank you, Bill. Go ahead.
I was just saying, we're happy to take any more questions if there are.
Okay, great. Well, thanks. And Bill will be on for this call, so I'm going to move to our first agenda item. But if you do have biosafety questions, I will try to slip them in as we have time. The first topic on our agenda today is CMS reimbursement update. We've had this topic on the calls before. There were a lot of questions that we were not able to get through, and as I mentioned, we do try to answer those questions or bring them back as an agenda item, bring back the topic as an agenda item so that we can provide more information to you. So today we've got two individuals from CMS to speak about this, Sarah Harding and Sarah Shirey-Loso. Sorry, I'm not doing well with last names today. Okay, so Sarah Harding, I think, you're up first.
Okay, great. Thank you. And thank you for having us back. I did bring Sarah Shirey-Loso with me to perhaps help with any questions or certainly back up if I misspeak. With the planners of the call, I don't have anything new to present today. There hasn't been a lot that has changed as far as payments around lab tests since the last time I spoke on this call, but as Jasmine mentioned, there were some outstanding questions that I thought I would try to walk through relatively quickly, and so certainly if there are follow-ups, we can answer them either during this call or after. But the list I have, I'll just read them out if that's okay and try to give brief answers. The first was whether we were aware of the status of recently requested CPT codes for a combination test of SARS-CoV-2 and influenza A and B. The answer is yes, we are aware of recently requested CPT codes. There are several actually that have come in, both from category one CPT codes, as well as proprietary laboratory analyses codes. All of these codes you will see with coverage and payment decisions made at the local MAC level. Since our timing at the national level occurs during the summer for new codes to come through a public meeting, anything that is new this time of year will be dealt with on the local level. So if there are questions about payment rates or coverage, I would recommend that you refer to your local MAC. This relates to the next outstanding question, which is whether if an organization has multiple MACs, who governs the rate assignment? I believe that the MAC overseeing a given test has to do with where the test is performed. There may be a lab that would have multiple MAC rates depending on, if they have multiple locations. And so depending on where, both where the sample is collected, and then ultimately the sample is performed, is the test is performed, would be the local MAC to contact, but they would also be able to help you with that. Can providers refuse samples because it will lengthen their turnaround time? I believe this had to do with the administrative ruling that was released in the last month or so, establishing an add-on code for high throughput COVID tests performed within 2 days. So can providers refuse samples? It's an interesting question. I don't think we have a particular payment policy that precludes a lab from doing that. I feel like that would have more to do with, you know, your just sort of labs being known that they're not taking samples. But again, I don't know that CMS necessarily has rules against refusing samples. The administrative ruling speaks to the turnaround time from the date of specimen collection to the date of the results completion. So that's kind of the extent to which the administrative ruling speaks to. If you're simply not bringing samples in the door, the administrative ruling really doesn't speak to that specifically. The next question is whether there are any blackout dates between rapid testing. They're asking about a homeless shelter or homeless entity wanting to test residents and staff weekly. Is this reimbursable under HRSA? So I can't speak to reimbursement under HRSA. So if that was meant to be reimbursable under CMS, you know, certainly you could ask, but again, if that's specifically to HRSA, I cannot speak to that. There's a question about other payers, speaking about having issues with patients not getting pre-authorized to be tested. So much like the prior question, I can't speak to the decisions that other payers are making. If we are not able to bill under the CARES Act, is it okay to bill the patient? Can they file for reimbursement? So to the extent of Medicare has an agreement for laboratory tests under the clinical laboratory fee schedule with the laboratory itself. I believe if you're working with Medicare as the payer, the lab would be the entity to bill, and not the patient. But again, if this question really was to a different payer, I can't quite speak to that. The lab may often not receive the specimen until the day after it's been collected. Can the 2-day time frame start when the laboratory actually receives the specimen? So this is a good question that we have been getting frequently, and we are working on a set of frequently asked questions to be published. Unfortunately, the process of getting these out in the world has sort of traditionally taken some time, and so unfortunately we haven't gotten those out as fast as we'd like. Generally speaking, what we're saying about the time frame is the day the specimen collection occurs is your day zero. So if you collect a specimen, you know, at any time on a Tuesday, whether it's at 1 a.m., 9 a.m., 7 p.m., whatever it is on that Tuesday, that's your day zero. To get the add-on code benefit, the test needs to be performed by the end of day two. So Wednesday would be day one, Thursday would be day two. You have the end of day two to complete that test. Hopefully that gives a little bit of wiggle room. But the goal of the administrative ruling was to encourage that 2-day time turnaround. Any idea of the reimbursement for COVID neutralization tests? I will admit I don't know what the COVID neutralization test is. So if anybody is on the call who asked that and wants to clarify, they would be more than welcome. But I would just say, generally speaking, if it is a test that has a CPT code, then it is up to the local MAC to make a coverage or payment decision. The last question I had related to, once again, the two-day calendar timeframe. So that's the same answer as I gave earlier. But like I said, we are working on some FAQs to clarify and make sure it's consistent across all labs. So those were the outstanding questions.
Thanks, Sarah. I do have a few more for you.
Okay.
The first thing, I just wanted to comment on that your last statement about the neutralization test. So that's an antibody serology test. So I don't know if that helps to clarify anything. I'm not sure if it has a CPT code.
So there are a couple codes that cover antibody testing. I don't know if that's specifically described. If it is, then it's under the same sort of characteristic that it's likely a test that you'd have to work with your local MAC with.
Okay, and so you keep mentioning the term or acronym MAC, and could you just say what that is?
I'm so sorry. Yes, I've definitely started to take that one for granted. Your MAC is your Medicare Administrative Contractor. So there are, I believe, 56 or so different jurisdictions across the country. Those are managed by various contractors that essentially administer payments for Medicare on a local level. So I think there are 6 or 7 overall MACs that each of those jurisdictions sort of gets grouped into. So if you have a question about who your local MAC is, MAC, you can look online on the CMS webpage. And you know, there's a whole map. You would be looking for lab tests. You would be looking for your Part B MAC, and they do differ depending on what area of Medicare you're in. But that is what you'd be looking for.
And here's another question for you: has CMS relaxed regulations for physicians to bill for COVID molecular tests if their CLIA is the lowest level? And I guess what they mean by lowest level, they're talking about a wave test.
So it looks like another group who is on this call would like to answer that question. At least there was a comment, and then it looks like it disappeared.
This question, well, that's us just kind of, you know, clicking them off so that we can keep track of which questions we're answering. So
Sorry. I thought somebody was reserving it for themselves. But I do think Amy Zale might be the better person to answer that question, just because it is CLIA. It is CLIA related. You know, generally speaking, from our perspective, there have been tests that are CLIA waived, so that some entities such as nursing homes and whatnot don't have to get a full CLIA certification in order to run the tests. But specific to physician labs, I don't know, Amy, I don't know if you have comments on that specifically.
I have to apologize. I didn't hear the initial question. Can you give me the question again, Jasmine?
Yeah, I will. And it's not so much about the CLIA level for physicians. It's about whether or not there's relaxed regulations for physicians to bill for COVID tests. And I don't know that if it has anything at all to do with the CLIA certification. And maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but if you guys could provide some clarification around that, that would be helpful. Do you want me to ask it again?
No, there isn't any relaxed regulation from a CLIA standpoint. It sounds like maybe the inquirer is asking if there's relaxed regulation around billing, but yeah. I don't believe that, from a CLIA perspective, obviously you need to have a CLIA certificate, whether it's a CLIA certificate of waiver or any of the sort of higher level CLIA certificates of compliance and accreditation. But I don't know from a reimbursement perspective how those CLIA certificates change reimbursement. I just know that you have to have them.
Okay. Sarah, anything else to add to that one?
Not really. I mean, I think related to physicians and COVID tests, I know that, and Amy mentioned this, kind of, there's certainly been the waiver for the initial order for the test, but in terms of regulations for billing, I don't know of specific relaxations around that.
Okay, just in the interest of time, I'm going to ask only one more question. There are two questions that are very similar. And it says, is reimbursement for an isothermal molecular test the same as a real-time PCR test?
Yes, I saw that. So that does relate to back to the CPT codes. And basically, whatever coding descriptor best describes the test, whether it's isothermal, whether it's molecular, whether it's antigen, the CPT codes are now getting more granular in terms of optical readability. So wherever the most descriptive, the most accurate description from a CPT code is the correct representation as far as billing goes.
Great. Thank you, Sarah, both Sarahs, for joining us today to answer questions about billing. I am going to move to our next speaker from CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and it will be Amy Zale, and she's going to be talking about the individualized quality control plan. We sent out a LOX message recently about this and received a lot of questions, and so Amy is going to also provide some additional information on that. Go ahead.
Thank you, Jasmine, and thanks for inviting me to talk today. I just wanted to share with everybody that CMS has heard a lot of feedback from the laboratory professional organizations as well as from laboratories themselves about supply chain issues. And we're hearing that there are continued reagent shortages and test kit shortages, and that our policy that came out about IQCP and EUAs really exacerbates that. We don't want to be part of the problem and want to be sensitive to the shortages that laboratories are dealing with. And in light of that, we are reviewing our policy regarding IQCP and EUAs. We are asking for everyone's patience as we reevaluate our policy and work to get further guidance out to you as soon as possible. So I saw after the last meeting that there were quite a number of questions about IQCP. And it's not the best thing for me to answer those questions as the policy states today, in light of the fact that we are reevaluating that policy. The other thing, there was another question that came from the last meeting that was talking about the Quidel SOFIA. And we just, it was at saying, the question was, I'm trying to get to the question now, but the question was about the Quidel SOFIA, and that the test is waived, and so did that mean that the laboratory was not responsible for quality control? And I just wanted to make sure that it was clear that the Quidel SOFIA test is authorized to be used in a certificate of waiver laboratory. And that does not mean that quality control is not required. Certificate of waiver laboratories are required to follow any and all manufacturers' instructions, As such, if quality control is required in the QuidelSophia manufacturer's instructions, laboratories are required to perform quality control as outlined. And so, Jasmine, I don't know if there are other questions that I can try to answer, but I would just reiterate that the IQCP and EUA policy is under review and probably not good for me to be answering questions about that today.
Okay. Well, thanks, Amy, and I'm sure you can see the Q&A box, and you can see that we are still getting a few questions about the IQCP. So once CMS has finalized their policy, we would be happy to send out a LOCS message with that clarification on the policy, and hopefully that will address a lot of these questions.
Definitely, and we'll be doing the same. We'll be trying to disseminate that far and wide as well.
Okay, great, thank you. All right, so we will go ahead and keep moving forward on our agenda. Our next speaker, as you've heard from him before, is Ren Salerno. He is the director of the Division of Laboratory Systems, and he's going to give an update on the COVID-19 antigen test and some lessons learned that CDC has developed. Ren?
Thanks, Jasmine. Yes, we at CDC have been actively following debates around the use of antigen tests ever since they were authorized for use by FDA. We've conducted a tremendous amount of outreach with users of these tests, as well as a lot of work with the manufacturers of the tests. And what has become clear to us is that a number of brand new testers have been introduced to testing for the first time with these antigen tests. And the perception has been that these are very easy to use, and they are relatively easy to use from a laboratory testing point of view, but they're not simple tests. And there are some complexities to these tests that are important for users to understand. And so the first thing that I will say, which is hopefully obvious to everybody on this call, is that every test must be used according to the manufacturer's instructions for use and the package insert, and that every test is unique, and every test may have its own specific way that it needs to be executed and performed for it to be used accurately. So next slide, please. What we've done at CDC is that we have collected some specific lessons learned on how to avoid process errors associated with the three major antigen tests that are currently on the market, the QuidelSophia 2, the BD Veritor, and the BinaxNOW Now. And on this first slide, we've listed a few of the specific potential process errors that can be associated with both the QuidelSophia and the BD Veritor. Yes, these are different tests. Yes, they have their own instructions for use and package inserts, and they should not be operated in exactly the same way. But for the sake of this presentation, these particular process errors are common or potentially common to both of these specific devices. It's really important that users change gloves between the tests to avoid any cross-contamination. Viral transport media should not be used with the specimen before the specimen is tested. Expired reagents or damaged test cassettes and devices should not be used. The timing of the reading of the results of these tests are extremely important, and so it's critical that users keep track of and follow the proper timing. And when we send out groups to do large-scale studies of these antigen tests, they all have a large number of timers that go with those studies, and so the timers and the effectiveness of the timing is really important for these antigen tests. The test cassette and device has to be used for each of these tests within a specified period of time after they are opened and exposed to ambient air. We have seen mistakes made or false results occur because the test cassettes have been opened from their package, left unopened on a table or counter for a period of time, and then used. But that lengthy exposure to ambient air can cause false results. The device itself must be kept in an horizontal position when in use and kept steady and still. So it can't be on a unlevel surface. And as I said before, the results must be interpreted within specific timeframes. And this is where reading the instructions is really critical. You must read and interpret the results within very specific timeframes. Otherwise, the results could change or be false. Next slide, please. This next slide focuses on the Binex Now COVID-19 Ag Card, which is also an antigen test, but it's a little bit different than the Quidel Sofia or the BD Veritor, in that there is no separate test device. The card itself is the reader and the test. And so these process errors are some potential process errors are somewhat different, and some of them are similar. Again, it's really important to change gloves between tests to avoid cross-contamination. The specimens have to be tested within at least or no more than 1 hour of collection. We recommend that the specimens are tested as soon as possible after collection with these tests. That must only use the correct volume of extraction reagent for each test, no more, no less. So it's very specific in terms of number of drops. Please read the instructions. Use of the kit reagents and cards should only be at room temperature. So where we've seen a couple of problems is these cards have been stored in cold storage and been used immediately before they've been brought to room temperature. So that's another example of an error that has happened with these particular cards. Again, just like the devices on the previous slide, the cards must be used in a horizontal position on a flat surface when the test is performed. Again, when the test is performed is extremely critical. The test results should be read promptly at 15 minutes after the swab is inserted. You need that timer. You need to set the timer the instant you place the swab into the card and start the test. You should not read the results before 15 minutes, and you can't read the results after 30 minutes. And so these are fairly specific to this particular test. But again, these are examples of errors that we've seen already with this particular test. Next slide, please. So in the interest of time, I will pretty much stop there, other than to say that these lessons learned for these three particular antigen tests, and we realize that there are more antigen tests now with emergency use authorization than just these three, although these three are, I think, currently in largest supply in the marketplace. We do intend to share these lessons learned documents that we have developed with anyone at CDC who is involved in antigen test studies or antigen testing work. We are sharing them with specific partners, including FDA and the manufacturers. As I said, we've developed these lessons learned with the manufacturers to ensure that we understand their instructions and that we're properly representing them. We are in the process now of converting these lesson learned documents for each of these three tests into infographics. And once those are approved and cleared at CDC, we will post those infographics on our point of care testing website, which we have talked about on this call before, but the link is there. And we will continue, once we do all of these things, especially when we publish them on our website, we will definitely send out a LOCKS message letting you know that. And the other thing I will add just to say is that we've also revised our antigen testing guidance. It is still in clearance. We believe it's very close to being fully cleared. We hope that it will be published within the next week or so. And you will see some of this information, a whole new section in that guidance on processing of antigen tests that take into account the various lessons learned that we've been able to acquire over the last few months. And you'll hear about that through a LOCKS message as well. Thanks, Jasmine. Over.
Thanks so much, Ren. So we did get a couple of comments in the Q&A box while you were talking. And the first one is about, the reaching the right audience for these lessons learned. The comment is, the folks on this call are laboratorians that are most likely not the ones that are using these particular wave tests or need these types of lessons learned documents because they are aware of the instructions for use and following them. So the question is, will the CDC be sending out these tips to CLIA wave locations where, these types of issues are more likely to come up? And I know you've mentioned already the point of care testing webpage that we have and, the laboratory outreach communication system messages that we send out. And, I will also comment that, for those folks on the phone, we also reach out to our professional organizations that are partners to CDC and help with promoting messages. And, just like them, I guess we could, also ask those that are on the call that if you're aware of facilities that are using these types of tests, to please forward these messages and communicate them broadly. We also work with another task force in the Emergency Operations Center that is predominantly providing support to nursing homes, and they are also promoting this information and messaging around the availability of this information. Ren, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, other than that this call is one of many, many different calls that we are on trying to spread this word around the importance of following the instructions for use and the challenges with performing these particular tests. And so we hear you, and we're doing the best we can to get this information out as widely as we can.
Yep. Okay, great. All right, the next question is related to the antigen antigen testing guidance. And the question is, can we use antigen testing like the BD Veritor for screening asymptomatics? I've seen this done all over, but it's technically against the EUA. In light of the warnings that FDA sent earlier this month on false positives for antigen testing, can we use it to screen for asymptomatics?
Yeah, so I know the answer to that question, but I think I'll let Tim Stenzel answer that question because, they've put out some messaging on testing of asymptomatics. CMS has also put out an FAQ on this issue, but I'll stop there.
Okay. Tim, do you want to jump in?
Sure. It's one of the questions that I was prepared to respond to. Hopefully you can hear me okay.
Yes, I can.
Yeah, so while there's a growing number of devices, IVD tests, that have been authorized for use with asymptomatic patients, most have not been authorized for that. And only extremely rare cases have we limited testing. It's very clear from the language in the authorization to only patients with symptoms. So the FDA has made clear, as I think, and supported by HHS, CDC2, and CMS, that off-label use is just fine for these tests. We are only beginning, obviously, to see performance of these tests, so we can't authorize them without data to support known performance data. But what we've said very clearly on our FAQ page is that these tests can be used off-label. They just need a valid, these are prescription devices, so just need a valid prescription. And you know, users that understand that the sensitivity in the asymptomatic population may be less. We've kind of seen some accumulating data, although very early, to that effect. And how less sensitive, don't know. And, you know, is that tied to how we validate these tests? Because it's really hard to tell with asymptomatic patients when they might begin shedding without symptoms, obviously. Or is there a different biology? Is there a lower level of virus, and truly it is more difficult to detect? So that all that is left to be seen. Some early data for one of the rapid tests that I've now seen in the last days has been real-world evidence that these devices are meeting our performance expectations when it comes to the symptomatic population, but it might be lower than what is in the package insert. So in real world situations, for whatever reason, the sensitivity seems to be, you know, at or slightly above 80% sensitivity. We set the bar for these without mitigation, other than it'd be by prescription at 80%. So, you know, they seem to be upholding that in real world situations. And that's good, but they're obviously not as sensitive as molecular tests are, nor do I think they need to be given the situation. Very clearly, I think if you're truly positive with an antigen test, you have, you know, virus around that could be transmissible. It is, however, difficult to imagine, you know, just to put it out there, you know, less sensitive antigen tests being useful less sensitive in the symptomatic population. But in the asymptomatic population, some of these data seem to show relatively low sensitivity. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, too early to tell. Very clearly, they're detecting positives in the asymptomatic population, which is important, I believe. And so we want to make these useful. So, you know, really HHS and CMS have cleared the path for this off-label use. CMS says you're not going to have a CLIA inspection issue. CMS can correct me if they want, you know, if you're using this, quote, off-label at the point of care. And HHS has said that, other things, which I would defer to them. So bottom line is, it's my recommendation that you consider using these devices in the asymptomatic population, that unless it's a high prevalence population, that you do confirm asymptomatic positives with a high sensitivity molecular test. So that was a long-winded, hopefully it's a good answer for folks.
And thanks so much for answering that question. And Ren, thank you for your update on the lessons learned documents and infographics for antigen tests. We're going to transition to our final update, which is Tim again, Tim Stenzel from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. And Tim, I'll just turn it over to you.
Thank you, Jasmine. And thank you, Ren, also for those tips. Not surprisingly, you know, and to people on this call, the instructions for use need to be followed. There are reasons for that. Not all lateral flow devices are the same. They may act similarly, at the basic science level, but they're actually fairly complicated devices to make them work, and timing and other things are very important, of course, just like any laboratory test. So the other questions we received, which I'll attempt to answer, are: is when does the public health emergency end? We don't know. The secretary would make that determination, Secretary of HHS. In the past, for the most recent public health emergencies, they remain open. So Zika, Ebola, for example, remain open. What happens with EUAs when the public health emergency ends? CDRH, our center, is drafting guidance that we believe will give sufficient time for developers of tests to convert to full authorization. So we realize that there's just a huge need for testing. It will remain so for a very long time, that developers across the board, labs and kits, have spent a lot of time and effort to make this available. And we have every desire to continue the availability of these tests. And so we're going to issue a guidance that's currently being drafted. Can't predict when it will be issued. I don't believe there's an urgent rush to do that. I don't think we're in urgent peril of having the public health emergency end, but that's not in our hands. We'll do our best to meet the need, but we expect to have a guidance that lays out timeframes for conversions to be made that we hope we found to be reasonable, and we'll continue the same access to testing that is currently available and is still growing, obviously. And then the second related question is how long will EUA submissions be accepted, I think is the question, and that is until the public health emergency ends. We will continue to accept EUA submissions. After it ends, then those will be different, and that will be governed by the final guidance that we're drafting now. So we'll refer to that. So those are the questions, Jasmine, that I had received up front and prepared. Don't know if there's other questions that have come in and you would like me to respond to now.
Okay, great. Thanks, Tim. Actually, we do have a couple of questions for you. The first one is, we have been presented with a question from our nursing colleagues asking to use NP swabs as MERS swabs because it's less invasive collection technique for COVID specimen collection. The published CDC guidance for collection doesn't specifically call out the circumstance, so do you have any comment on whether or not it's appropriate to use the NP swabs in replacement of the NAIR swab for testing?
Yeah, that's not the first time that we've received that question, and it's a bit odd because we obviously had a short supply of NP swabs for a while, but apparently there's a relative abundance now since the FDA has clearly authorized lots of anterior nares and a growing number of mid-turbinate nares assays, which are much easier to collect and patients prefer them, obviously. The NP swab is not designed the same as the anterior nasal swab. And so we don't know if it will perform the same for sure. It may not. So we would advise against it unless, you certainly have no choice. And then understand that, neither the developers or the FDA have a performance understanding of this swab. So I understand there may be a need. I just urge caution, and only when you cannot get the authorized swab. I don't know the other implications for the other agencies and their view of this. It would obviously be ideal to validate that, but that's obviously involves work as well. But they are not, to make clear, they are not designed to be interchangeable.
Okay. Thanks, Tim. Okay, the next question is there any timeline for COVID-19 serology LDTs that were submitted for EUA in the summer?
Can you ask that question again, the turnaround time for serology EUAs?
It's the timeline for COVID-19 serology LDTs that were submitted for EUA.
Okay, so we are still, of course, the HHS came out with a statement initially that the FDA about FDA requirements for EUAs for LDTs, and then more recently has made statements about the FDA reviewing LDTs. And at this moment, I still have to say that we're in conversation with HHS, and stay tuned. Hopefully, we'll have more information in the near future.
Okay, I've got one more for you. If a product such as a molecular test that has not yet received EUA and is being sold through the notification pathway, can it be used in a point-of-care settings that are owned by a healthcare system that has a high-complexity laboratory, or can testing only be performed within the four walls of the actual high-complexity clinical laboratory in the main hospital, for example?
What the FDA has said, and we're probably not the only authority here, is that if, and it's based obviously on dialogue with other agencies, but I defer to them, it's the CMS and CDC, but it's our view at the FDA that if that point of care facility is covered by the high complexity certificate or the lab, you know, so that it's sort of within the high complexity lab, so to speak, then it should be fine. But these devices that are only by notification have not been authorized for anything other than a high complexity lab situation.
Okay, one more, Tim. For the LIAT combo test, flu SARS, since the VTM is in short supply, can any swab VTM be substituted and the test still be waived?
So this is lateral flow. I didn't catch the
I think so. I'm not familiar either with this acronym. It says LIAT combo test for flu and SARS. We may have to come back to this one. And
maybe it's maybe it's LIAT rather than LAIT. There's the Roche Liat point of care test.
Yeah.
It's probably what they're referring to. But just to be clear, the concern, and that is with lateral flow devices, we've seen significant numbers of false positives with some devices with some VTM, and obviously VTM would dilute a sample for a lateral flow device. But I believe this question is about the Roche Liat, which is a molecular assay, and I would defer to the manufacturer. Any questions about a suitable VTM with their product? And I wouldn't want to presume that I know the performance in the different ones. I would say that in general, if you send that question into our CDRH-EUA-template at fda.hhs.gov, we can look up what's specifically in the instructions for use, and we can ask the experts on our team who are in the know about the Roche Liat to know if there's any theoretical issues, because the manufacturer in all likelihood will probably stick to what's in the IFU, and we would like to be at the FDA at least as helpful as possible. So that's a great question. In fact, I'll try to capture it and try to answer it on the next call, okay? But we can, whoever's asking the question can send it to our template's email address and get a more rapid response.
Great, that would be helpful. Okay, I've got another one. Off-label use has generally been considered on a patient-by-patient basis by the patient's healthcare provider. Can off-label use literally be applied to an entire population or group, as opposed to a traditional patient-by-patient consideration?
So if it's specifically intended for testing asymptomatic individuals with the vast majority of lateral flow antigen tests and molecular tests that we've authorized, I believe, you know, there may be state law, state and local law issues, but the FDA at least is fine with a blanket prescription for a population, say a nursing home, a school, a workplace, or other similar venues, or a blanket clinical order is made for this purpose, and it does not need to have an individual script. That's at least from the FDA perspective. I defer to other agencies if they have, and state and local laws if they have any other considerations.
Okay, great. And for that last question that you were just answering, and you gave out that email for a more rapid response, I'm showing it on the slide for the individual who submitted that question. If you want to send it to this email address, as Tim mentioned, it would be addressed a lot faster than the next call. And with that,
and make sure that they ask for me to be involved too, so that I can help address the question. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. With that, we are at the end of our agenda and pretty much almost out of time. So I do want to thank everybody again for joining us today. And a couple reminders: our next call will be on December 14th at 3 p.m. If you're not receiving announcements for these calls, please send an email to locs@cdc.gov. You will get information about our calls as well as other information that we send out through that system. We want to thank you all for everything that you've been doing for what feels like almost a year now to support the COVID-19 response. And we appreciate all the questions that you've submitted, all of your suggestions for agenda items. Again, we hope that these calls are helpful to all of you. And we will talk again in 2 weeks. Thanks again for joining us.